So this is the concurrent session on climate change. And let me just briefly introduce our presenters today. Firstly, Kate McKenzie is the Investment and Governance Manager of the Climate Institute. And Kate is the author of Climate Change and Australia's Financial System, published in July 14, which led to invitations to brief numerous senior financial sector regulatory figures on systemic and institutional financial climate risk. And she joined TCI in 2014 after working as a journalist for the Financial Times for 10 years in London, Australia. And during this time, she held various roles, including corporate reporter, senior editor, head of online editorial development, and the list goes on. Prior to this, she worked at The Australian as a technology business reporter, and she also worked at Australia's first commercial internet service provider. So Kate is very well qualified to speak to us today. Sharanjit Padam is the convener of the Climate Change Working Group of the Actuaries Institute and a member of Climate Change Working Party of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries and a principal at Deloitte. He's acted as appointed actuary to four insurers and has over 20 years' experience in the general insurance and accident compensation industries. And his joint paper with Professor Andy Pittman, climate scientist at Uni of New South Wales, and John Harwood at Suncorp, entitled Can Actuaries Afford to Ignore Climate Change, won the Taylor Fry Silver Prize at the GI seminar in 2014. Sharanjit's also well qualified to speak to us today. And without further ado, I'll invite Sharanjit to the podium. And so the format is Sharanjit and Kate are going to give some presentations, and then hopefully there'll be an opportunity for Q&A at the end. Over to you, Sharanjit.
Thanks, Lindsay. So, Kate and I are going to be talking about climate risk in financial institutions, we are going to go through basically four questions today. Why should we as financial institutions care about climate risk? How will it affect us as financial institutions? What are the opportunities? And what should we do? So I would have started with this quote from the chairman and CEO of AXA, France's largest insurer. He said this in 2014, climate risk for us is neither an ideological or theoretical issue. It is a core business issue, as we are already seeing the impact of increasing weather-related disaster risks. And he goes on to talk about the costs that AXA are seeing in their portfolio, particularly in Europe. And after this, AXA announced a massive divestment from carbon assets and a massive investment into green bonds. So that's the lens we're coming to this from. This is not an environmental or feel-good green issue. This is a core business issue, and that's very much what we want to talk about. Another quote here for you. Mark Carney last year stood up in front of the Lutine Bell at Lloyd's of London and announced to the assembled industry that the combination of the weight of scientific evidence and the dynamics of the financial system suggests that, in the fullness of time, climate change will threaten financial resilience and longer-term prosperity. I put it to you that as actuaries, we are fundamentally concerned about financial resilience and longer-term prosperity. So the Bank of England in their report also split climate risk into three areas, which we think are very useful ways of looking at the issue. So first of all, talking about physical risks, this would be the property damage from weather events such as storms, cyclones, floods. And some of these might be insured or they might be assets held by institutions that are not insured. So that's the risk, the first risk, your property is going to be damaged or... The second issue is what Mark Carney termed transition risks. And these are financial risks that arise from a transition to a low-carbon economy. It may include sudden changes in asset values, and it's driven by policy, technology, and assessment of physical risk. So that's a bit vague, I think, and we'll try and give you some more detail about what that is. The third risk that the Bank of England talked about, particularly for general insurers in the UK market, was liability risks. So it's not just a property damage issue. There are insured liabilities for losses arising from compensation for damage from climate change. The old principle that if you've caused something that's then caused damage to me, I'm going to sue you for that, for compensation. There's no reason why that logic doesn't apply to climate change. Or legal actions through directors, against directors, trustees, investment managers for failing to adapt to or mitigate against climate change. And we've already seen a few of these go through the courts. So going back to the transition risks issue, here's how policy might drive transition risk. So what we know from the latest estimate from the IEA is that if we want to stay below 2 degrees centigrade in terms of temperature rises, we can only burn 900 gigatons of carbon. We already have access to, and there are assets out there that are listed or unlisted, of nearly 3,000 gigatons. So roughly two-thirds of those assets cannot be burnt. Those assets will never be used if governments and companies enact policy to stop, to limit temperature rises to 2 degrees centigrade. So as an investor, you might want to be, you might be concerned about that, particularly if you're invested in fossil fuel companies, in oil companies, coal companies, or gas companies. So if you are holding on to these assets, then become stranded, you are facing losses, and that's a transition risk. As we move to a low-carbon economy, assets will lose their values. Someone asked me the question, how soon will we burn through that 900? So this graph attempts to answer that question. This is the rate at which we're burning at the moment. At this point here, which is 2035, we will have burnt all of that 900 gigatons of carbon dioxide. These are the other paths that are proposed in terms of reducing emissions over time. As you can see, the thing to take from this graph for me is that the later we leave it, the faster we have to transition, the steeper the curve is, and therefore the greater the potential disruption to the assets. Okay, so generally speaking, we're going to talk you through this idea that we should care about climate risk because climate affects our economy, which then affects our investments in those economic activities. We as financial institutions engage in a lot of that investment. We have customers who will be affected, and our shareholders will also be affected. That's why we should care. Another aspect in terms of our customers who are impacted by climate change, customers look to us as an industry to provide them with financial protection. As all these industries are around in some shape or form to provide financial protection to customers, so we need to be concerned about that. Here are some examples of the ways that the economy might be affected by climate change. So on the top left here, we're talking, this is a Tesla battery, you strap it to your house. It fills up with solar power during the day, and at night it pumps it out. That allows you to completely disconnect your house from the grid, bye-bye any kind of poles and wires you're paying for. This thing will massively disrupt the energy, electricity distribution industry. To the effect that all the main providers of electricity distribution are already now trying to sell these batteries as well to you because they realize their business model is up. We've already talked about the policy responses. Sea level rises. Sea level rises plus increased storm surge activity is going to mean that homes, let's put it this way, 85% of Australian property homes are within 50 kilometres of the seashore. So if we're talking about sea level rises and we're talking about increased cyclones and floods, there's a chance that those houses won't be able to get insurance anymore, at which point they may not be able to be sold, at which point people might think it's not a good idea to carry on paying their mortgage repayments or home loan repayments on those. So if you're a bank holding onto these properties, you should be concerned. Also talking about agricultural land change. As the climate changes, the yields and the viability of different agricultural crops in different areas will change. We're already seeing this. Not just that, but also the pests that grow in different areas will also change. We're already seeing this in the wine industry in Australia, where yields have been reducing, especially in the northern parts, and the wine industry is desperately acquiring land in Tasmania at the moment in order to keep up their production. We will also see increased tropical diseases, and that was going to change the health risks faced by the population of Australia, and it's going to change our health needs. In terms of the health industry, it will also change health insurance. And the last one here, the northern Great Barrier Reef is currently going through a bleaching event. 90% of that northern Great Barrier Reef is now dead at this point in time. We've had two such bleaching events in recorded history in the past, and the reef has recovered. Hopefully it will recover, but there doesn't look any sign of the temperatures, the water temperatures falling, which is what it's going to require for those reefs to recover. Anyone who lives in Queensland or has been around that part of Queensland knows how important the reef is to all sorts of economic activity. So I hope I've shown you examples from all these industries that will be affected by climate change, from agriculture, tourism, mining, energy, health, housing, infrastructure, employment. I've stuck in some good news stories. We might have more demand for our uranium. We might have more demand for the rare metals that are required to make solar panels. There's alternative sources of energy that Australia is exceedingly rich in. We have one of the richest coastlines for wind power in the world. We have obviously a lot of sunshine. From the agriculture side, while we will lose viability of certain crops, we will gain viability of other crops as well. So that's sort of orange change. This will all have huge implications for infrastructure and population movement. People are going to have to move around in Australia to different places in order to live. That's going to change also how we're employed. Right now, the Mining Council of Australia talks about 200,000 people employed directly or indirectly through the coal industry in Australia. If we stop mining coal, what are we going to do with those 200,000 people? Where are they going to work? Where are they going to live? So these questions naturally arise. Those sectors of the economy, this is the latest figures from the ABS in terms of gross value added, make up about 48% of economic activity now. Climate change obviously won't impact the whole 48%, but it's going to have a significant impact on a large part of that. So this to me gives a sort of a good sense of the magnitude of the issues that we're going to face in terms of climate change. And that's only talking, by the way, about primary effects. Hopefully we're here to talk about what the impact on the financial services sector will also be. So there are other secondary effects as well. What can financial institutions do? From the general insurance side, we're going to see increased frequency and severity of losses. We're going to see change in location. One of the big concerns to many general insurers is the movement of cyclones further south than they've been occurring in the past. The biggest concern about that is that the building standards further south are not built to be cyclone-proof. The Gold Coast building standards don't survive cyclones. The analysis that John Harwood and myself and a few other actuaries have attempted has shown that we're perhaps not going to see such a great rise in the average premium across Australia. But that hides a couple of problems. One is that it's not a uniform effect. So say, for example, you're in one of the 3% of Australian properties that is affected by flood, you will see a lot of change in your insurance premiums. But the other 97% won't. So on average, there's not much of a change. But for the people for whom it matters, it'll be a huge change. Secondly, technical point, but when you have tailed heavily skewed distributions, a small change in the mean is actually accompanied by a much larger change in your tails. So your capital, if you're having risk-based capital, you're increasing your risk-based capital if it's a value at risk type of formula, increases multiple times that of the change in the mean. So what that means is that the capital required to run our general insurance business is going to increase. So there will be some effects of that on pricing, but I don't think that the regulators certainly, and I don't think insurers are yet aware of the increasing capital requirements they're going to require to run the business that's still viable to be insured. We've already talked about life and health, and I think that one of the points to note there is people often talk about climate change being about this thing in the future. However, when you're writing 30-year contracts, such as a life insurer might write for a protection product, or a bank might write for a home loan, you're already at risk. Now, you've already written contracts that are carrying risk for climate change. General insurers, paradoxically, might be the best to survive because they can walk away. Unfortunately, if they walk away too much, they will run out of business to write. I'm now going to pass on to Kate, who's going to talk a little bit about some of the other issues.
Thanks. So I'm just going to give you a few examples of situations where climate change has potentially already resulted in risks and costs of some form. This one is ANZ is a really interesting one. This is just quite recent. They raised their write-downs. I think in February they'd forecast about $800 million in losses, and then just a few weeks later they had to increase that by $100 million. Now, Bloomberg News reported that was probably mostly due to Peabody and Arium, and you probably all know that Peabody is now in Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in the US, as are several other large thermal coal companies. So it's arguable what percentage of Peabody's problems arise from climate change, but certainly it's really widely agreed that a part of it, at least, was due to US clean air regulations that were introduced over the last few years. So it's already kind of approaching the point where we can point to quite tangible examples of losses, and although that's, you know, relatively small for a bank of ANZ size, it's, you know, as Sharanjit mentioned, you know, we're still in very early stages of seeing some of these things. And it's been pointed out, by in that same Bloomberg report by one investor that there could be secondary effects from that, that they're interested in how secondary effects of the general resources downturn is going to affect the banks. And Fitch Ratings and Digital Finance Analytics have both done sort of postcode mortgage impairment research in Australia, and both noted that mining areas have had high rates of impairment over about the last 18 months. I think about 18 months ago they started noticing that. So it's just an example of where you might see flow-on effects that are not necessarily kind of obviously directly related, but might be sort of indirectly related. So if some of those areas are thermal coal, very, very reliant on thermal coal extraction, for example, like certain parts of Queensland, then that could be a factor already. This is more of a sort of encouraging example, I guess. One of the things my organisation does is we several years ago launched something called the Asset Owners Disclosure Project, which is now run out of London, and it's a global initiative. But it started in 2007 to rate how large asset owners are managing climate risk and thinking about it. And it was one of the first initiatives that really looked at climate as a purely financial risk, not as a do-goody kind of ethical thing, but how are you looking at it across your portfolio as a financial material risk. Anyway, so that's one. That's how I came across, this example of First State Super. There's some other really good examples of super funds in Australia that have done quite innovative things to manage their climate risk as well. But I think this one's particularly interesting because they've been quite clear about looking at it across their entire portfolio and looking at specifically at the physical impacts of climate change and how that might affect their portfolio. So it's not just about having a you know, ESG or an SRI option for some investor, for some super members who wish to opt into that because of their own beliefs. It's actually looking across the portfolio, starting with infrastructure and property. Those are the most kind of obvious asset classes where you would have those exposed assets, but they're going to do it across all of their asset classes. And it also kind of demonstrates, I think, that it's now possible to do that, and I'll get into a little bit more detail about why that is in a minute. There's another... We mentioned, or Sharanjit mentioned early on, this three categories of risk, of types of climate risk. So there's physical impacts, there's transitions, and then the third one is liability risk. This one kind of arises from the other two risks, and it's not just as simple as being directly liable for, say, emissions that might lead to a particular climate event. That causality, as you can imagine, is very difficult to prove. There have been a couple of attempts that generally haven't been that successful, but what is emerging are the sorts of things that are starting to emerge are examples of where an insurer has attempted to recover costs. So this is something that happened in 2014 where there was quite a lot of flooding damage in Illinois, and a general insurer, actually several general insurers, gathered together to launch a class action against the state's water authority for allowing their infrastructure to get into such a bad shape that it wasn't, basically didn't protect a lot of their members against flooding. Now, interestingly, that case was later dropped because there's tort immunity for state authorities in Chicago. There's a few interesting implications of that, which is that behind Illinois Farmers is actually they're actually an Allianz insurer, and Allianz are also the insurer for the water authority. So they're kind of on both. So there's been some speculation that maybe this is more of a bit of signalling, and it does kind of indicate that the quote at the end there does indicate that maybe that's the case. So the point is that they wanted to make clear that infrastructure owners, whether they're sort of private sector or public sector, need to start incorporating increased flooding and that type of thing, known increased impacts into into how they maintain their assets, and that insurers don't want to wear that cost. This is another example. This is more of a transition risk, I suppose. So the New York Attorney General has done a couple of interesting things the last few months. One is that they reached an agreement with Peabody about how Peabody had been talking about the risk of climate change in some of its published materials to shareholders. I believe that came down to, for example, when they're talking about the risks of action on climate change to their core business, they were tending to use very favourable scenarios from the IEA. So often when people are talking about climate trajectories, they use International Energy Agency scenarios, and Peabody had used the one suggesting, the least action on climate change, and so they would be fine. So they actually reached an agreement that there was a settlement with the New York Attorney General, but now there's a separate initiative by the New York Attorney General and a bunch of other state Attorney Generals in the US and also the US Virgin Islands about how much Exxon was being upfront with its shareholders, not just with the public but also with its shareholders, about what it knew about climate change internally and whether that was reflected in the way it was communicating to shareholders and to the general public. So that's really interesting thing to keep an eye on. And just getting towards, in a practical sense, what might you be able to do about this? If you work for an organisation where you think maybe some of this would be within our realm, I tend to get a lot of questions in my job about, how do we start dealing with this? We don't know. It's this very complicated area and of a very specific expertise, which is all really true. Usually organisations, financial institutions, start with looking at how they can measure their climate risk. There are different ways of doing that. it's not easy always to, it's not easy, full stop. It's not easy even to know necessarily the best way to do it, although that is getting easier and it's getting clearer. It is getting to the point now where I think it is possible to take a position, and as I, you know, showed with the First State Super example, there are big asset owners that are already doing this, that are, and, you know, similarly with AXA, there's the Norwegian Oil Fund. There's a lot of examples out there in the world now of large financial institutions that are looking at their climate risk across their portfolio and taking a position. We also just mentioned board level at the bottom, because it's something that I've found is that, you need your board to understand this. I'm not an expert in board obligations and director obligations, but there is a bit of thinking about this. There's a really interesting lawyer called Sarah Barker, who works for Minter Ellison, who's written a few things about this, which I'll put some links in the slides for further reading. And then on the upside, it's not just all about managing risks and getting out of particular assets or exposures. There are potentially some really interesting opportunities there. In equities is probably the asset class where there's been the most work done. There are various commercial service providers like MSCI and even FTSE that do, you know, fossil-free indexes, low-carbon indexes. It's quite interesting one from FTSE. I can't obviously recommend any of them specifically, but there are also, private. There are various firms out there that do this kind of analysis of companies and their climate risk across their whole business. So that's probably equities are probably the most, you know, one of the easiest starting points. Particularly for transition risk. Fixed income, there's huge amounts of excitement about climate bonds and green bonds. They're a fairly new development, I think maybe sort of 3 or 4 years old now. And there's been, it's still a pretty small subsection of you know, bond issuance in total, but demand has been really high for all of the issues so far. They've been well oversubscribed, compared to similar bond issues with similar assets behind them. Although the rate of return is kind of fairly similar, there's a tendency for the owners to hold on to them for longer. So that's interesting for the issuers as well, and underwriters, obviously. Infrastructure and property, again, it's that one is, if you're a large direct investor, probably the simplest in some ways, especially in terms of climate impacts. In commercial property sector, for example, there's been a lot of thinking about, the green building standards and so on. That's been kind of fairly well established now. And any of you who are in that area will probably know all about it. It is true that there is still a big shortage of opportunities in terms of if you want to reduce your climate risk and get into more climate-safe assets, clean energy assets. The $5 trillion shortfall comes from a Bloomberg New Energy Finance white paper published early last year. And that was just based... That's a pretty rough and ready calculation. They looked at if every, they kind of hypothesised if every asset owner got out of fossil fuel stocks, which is not necessarily the solution or the, you know, the beginning or end of the story, I'd like to say. But if in theory that happened, then where would all that money go? And what they concluded was that there's just not enough alternative and clean energy assets to get into. So on the bright side, maybe there's opportunities for origination, securitization and so on. I'll definitely acknowledge it's an issue. Just going back to the First State Super example that I mentioned, I think it's something that's really important to be aware of. Sharanjit mentioned that he did a paper with a presentation a couple of years ago with Professor Andy Pittman from Uni of New South Wales, who's also head of the Australian Research Centre for Excellence in Climate Modelling. He's a really world-class climate modelling scientist. This is a paper that Andy co-authored, which looks at the effects of urban heat islands and climate change in Western Sydney. And what they did was previously global climate models have only, it's only been really possible to downscale them to grid areas on a map of about 100 kilometres. This paper demonstrates that you can now do it down to squares of about 2 kilometres. What they've done there is combined average temperature increases with urbanisation and without urbanisation. It's a very interesting paper, but it's also interesting in terms of a demonstration of what the technology can do. And Andy's quite articulate about this and thinks, you know, and says he's starting to see this be applied far more widely and more quickly than he expected, this kind of granular, you know, small-scale modelling. Another kind of reason to be cheerful is, although, as I mentioned before, there's a lot of different ways of looking at this, there's numerous different ways of potentially measuring your risk and then approaching it, apparently about 400. There's a process underway this year that was initiated by the Financial Stability Board, which is G20 affiliated organisation of financial authorities from the G20 countries. So they set up in December last year a task force to start developing a framework for assessing and comparing climate risk between companies, and it's going to address all types of companies. So originally it was going to be non-financial corporates, but it's also going to include financial institutions as well. So far, they've just come out with phase one of the report, but they're due to have the whole framework developed by the end of this year, which is pretty ambitious, and good luck to them. But it'll be a very useful thing. The FSB launched a similar initiative with called the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force about 4 years ago when it was first set up, probably more like 5 years ago actually. Which was just for comparing bank capital risk, because, you know, in recognition of the fact that banks had just become incredibly complex and investors needed a consistent methodology for comparing them. So this is taking the same approach. It's a private sector working group. We have an Australian member on there who's Dr. Fiona Wilde from BHP, and she briefed some other organisations in Australia the other day about this, and it sounds like it's going to be really interesting when it comes out and quite useful. And now I'm going to pass back to Sharanjit to just finish up and we can take questions.
So one of the questions that we ask ourselves in the climate area space is why aren't people doing things? And you know, scientists have been talking about this for 30 years. The financial impacts seem very obvious to us, it's useful sometimes to try and put yourself in your feet and their feet and work out why what are the barriers to change and what's causing them. Unfortunately, it's very hard to do that and then not conclude that they're not valid reasons. But this thing about it being too far in the future, I think, is one thing we come across. We've already said that. In so many industries, we write 30-year contracts that are exposed already, so it's not a future issue. It's too unknown. Well, actually, it's not. There's a lot of information coming through. And actually, the more uncertainty that's out there, the more you need a plan. I think it's a basic actuarial idea that you need to plan for the things that are uncertain. Some barriers to change have been this idea that no one else is doing anything, why should we? And that's just not the case. Australian super funds are amongst the leaders in this area. Some Australian super funds are amongst the leaders in this area. But we've also seen actions by AXA and other insurers, particularly European insurers, and sovereign funds like the Norwegian Sovereign Fund, which was at 800 trillion. Assets, something like that, has taken action on the same issue. Aviva in the UK is taking action on this. And also the question about lacking capability. Well, exactly how do we do this? We're not able to do these exercises. But I think the that capability has been acquired, the technology and the ability to measure things, particularly in terms of assets and modelling down to 2 kilometres square. A couple of weeks ago, Carl Mallon from the Climate Risk Group launched a website where you can go and have a risk assessment done to your property, down to an individual property level. So the reality is that the technology is catching up, and the ability for us to do something about this is increasing rapidly. Oops, wrong way. I think, you know, in terms of thinking about our capabilities, there's sort of a low, medium, kind of high capabilities. Characteristic of a low capability would be that, you know, the risk is not addressed, there's no identification of the risk, and you have a very reactive risk culture. Medium, perhaps you have climate risk as sort of part of your corporate relations aspect. Maybe you have identified some risk but not actually tried to quantify them. A higher capability would be integrating your risk management plans and having a strategy to deal with climate risk, identifying and quantifying your risk, and also having a leading risk culture that you're out there to lead on the issue. We've already talked about the improving knowledge around that. The Actuaries Institute working group that I'm a part of, we're seeking to improve the knowledge in the actuarial space about this issue and what can be done. So just some conclusions we hope that you'll take away from what we've said so far. First of all, we think there's a need to think wider about climate risk. It's Margaret Atwood, who's an author and an activist, I think put it very well. She says climate change is everything change. And that's, I think, the best starting point when you think about climate change. It's not just about coal, and it's not just about natural disasters. We have exposure both through direct business operations in the financial service industry, but we also have indirect exposure through our investments. The risk is pervasive and systemic, and potentially material to financial condition, in my view. Financial institutions are already at risk. It's not a problem for the future. The solutions start with applying a risk management framework, and we are purportedly experts in that area as actuaries. So I think we have a lot to add and a lot to do. There are multiple stakeholders who are affected by the financial risks of climate change, and doing nothing is not a realistic option and may be a governance risk, increasingly becoming a governance risk. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Kate and Sharanjit. Now, we've got just a few minutes left for questions. Morning tea is due at 10:50, so 7 minutes' time or so. But if we have some questions, could I just ask you to come to the microphone on the floor there just so it can be heard and it's also recorded, and state your name, please.
Hi, Margaret Bishop. I was just wondering if you had any sort of, I guess, simple suggestions or first steps that insurers or superannuation funds could take in moving towards measuring their climate risk.
I think, we might have different views on this. I think there's kind of an audience of actuaries, I think. as has been mentioned, there's a working group looking at this in the Actuaries Institute. Might be a good place to start. There are a few organisations as well, like industry groups. So there's things like there's UNPRI. If your company is a member of the UNPRI, they do a fair bit of work on climate change now. There's an Australian industry group called the Investor Group on Climate Change, which is very active in this space. They have super funds and some asset managers as members, and For banks, there's an initiative. Australian banks have actually started an initiative that's affiliated to the UNPRI, I think, or one of their big international kind of organisations, which is looking at how to measure and address climate risk for banks in particular. So those are a few examples. It depends on the industry, I guess, that you're in. But the ICA, if you're in insurance, the ICA has also made clear that they're also looking at this as well for their industry. So, you know, Carl Sullivan will know all about that at the ICA. And
I mean, there are a lot of organisations, including my own organisation at Deloitte, that do sustainability services to assist people. So I think the starting point is your classic risk management framework starting point, and to start off with a risk identification process, identify all your places where you have risk, and then start to slowly quantify that over time. But I think it's important to start a strategy, because you also have a publicity and a governance issue around this. As you've seen, there's a lot of shareholder activity. I know boards are getting increasingly asking questions at AGMs from their shareholders, who might be coming from an environmental activist place, but also, I think, genuinely concerned about the shareholder value that is being eroded through lack of action around this issue.
Naomi, I think you had a question.
Naomi Edwards, thanks. That was a great presentation. What do you say to boards when you give them examples like the ANZ $100 million write-down, and they say, look, what's happening in the coal space is just a cyclical downturn. It's no different to the iron ore downturn. You can't prove that it's climate change related. Are you aware of any research or good answers to that statement?
Yeah, so I picked that one because it's a really good example for that argument, I guess. So look, it's difficult to attribute these things right now. There are a lot of factors influencing commodity markets and resources at the moment. Obviously, China's economy, which has been a favourite topic of mine over the last few years when I was writing for the FT, Peabody is a really good example, because there's really not much doubt that it is the US Clean Air Act that's had an impact that's at least partly to blame, thank for. Not that a company going under is necessarily a good thing in any case, but those laws in the US enacted via the Environmental Protection Authority were specifically aimed at reducing carbon dioxide emissions. They also target air pollution, so sulfur dioxide and mercury, but it's quite clear, and the administration of the US has been quite clear that it's part of their approach to reducing carbon dioxide emissions, and it's part of their approach to reduce for the US as a country that's committed to keeping climate change within the below the 2 degree or 1.5 degree. Bound of safety, that's part of what they've done. And I don't think anyone would argue that that's had a material effect on Peabody. Obviously, they're also an exporter to China, so that's had an effect. But China's coal consumption has flattened over the last couple of years. And there's a factor, again, it's probably partly due to their international climate commitments, partly due to urban pollution concerns. But I don't think it's not a very difficult case to make that climate is definitely a factor in that, and I can dig up lots of financial analysts pondering that thermal coal in particular is in structural decline, and it's not cyclical. You could really couldn't quite say the same, I think, for things like iron ore. We're still going to need certain kinds of materials to build a clean energy infrastructure.
Sorry, I just went conscious of time, but I guess I was thinking about this morning, actually, because I don't think if someone's going to believe me as an actuary about this, then I think that's a fundamental problem. I'm not the expert on this, and I never will be the expert on it. I'm not here to convince you about this. I think you're far better talking to And being convinced by the scientists around the issue and being convinced by, you know, a whole bunch of people who have a lot more influence than me, perhaps the Pope, perhaps Obama, perhaps, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger or Leonardo DiCaprio. I mean, sorry, I'm being a bit flippant here, but I think there is a point to be made that if you genuinely believe that coal isn't just a cyclical decline, there are going to be lots of cheap assets for you to buy up out there, and it'll be a very interesting strategy. I would suggest you start heavily investing in carbon capture storage, because if you happen to own all the coal mines and you've successfully cracked carbon capture storage, you will make a mint and your shareholders will love you. So good luck with that strategy.
So I think we have time for just one final question, Tony.
I'm conscious of time. Tony Coleman, as some of you would know, I've been fairly interested in this space for some time with a number of different hats. Can I suggest to you perhaps being just a little bit pessimistic in your overall assessment here? You sort of seem to be saying we haven't really got very far and, you know, we've got a long way to go. I don't see where we've got a long way to go, but if you look back 10 years or more, actually we've come quite a long way in community and government understanding about this, but the real issue, I think, is as you try to make progress in this space, you run into some pretty serious vested interests, and those vested interests fight back. And that's really what slows down progress. And, of course, you do have some people who associate climate change with a non-economic, non-capitalism green agenda, which they see they have a real values problem with, even though that's totally irrelevant, as I think you've pointed out fairly well if you look at it objectively in this presentation. But nevertheless, you have to recognise that those people are out there. Some of them are very influential, and you have to work your way around them. So I might just leave it at that as an observation, but obviously you can see it as a question and respond to if you wish. And I'm also very conscious of, you know, the work Naomi's done, and particularly in Tasmania. And as someone who visits Tasmania quite a bit with a sort of climate-related hat on still, the thing that you didn't mention but is quite interesting, Tasmania's going through a pretty serious climate crisis at the moment, with a combination of, until very recently, low rainfall and no Basslink. It's created all sorts of problems down there. So they're getting serious climate risk right now. And another good example, which I only heard of quite recently, people keep talking about sea level rise and how it's going to affect the Pacific Islands. I don't think many of you would know, but the people of Kiribati, who of course go underwater pretty quickly, they've actually started buying land, freehold, in Fiji so they can move their people. That's how seriously they're taking it. So I'll leave it at that.
Just say really quickly, thanks. I think they're really, yeah, good points. And I think also Tasmania and South Australia are really interesting to look at in terms of transition and to a degree, particularly in Tasmania, impacts. For optimism, I try and think of things like technology, Tesla, you know, electric cars, battery storage has improved a lot. I was writing about energy 5 years ago for the FT, and batteries were just considered to be something that could not really be improved, and that was seen as a really big barrier to renewables, but we have actually seen some, you know, it's really surprised me how much that's improved. So, yeah, but the pessimism thing is, it's tricky. People tell us, you know, if you work in climate change in any capacity, you always get told, be more positive. So we try. It's hard.
I do want to acknowledge that you know we are standing on the shoulders of giants here. That there have been a lot of work done in this on this area over the last few years. I just hope more people do work in this area and wake up to this. I think that it's surprising when I go to all these conferences and people talk about this new big disruptor that's going to change everything, and it's very hard from that point of view to say, well, actually, there's this big one here called climate change that's going to radically alter your industry. Please pay attention to that as well. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all of you for coming and for your contributions from the floor. And please join me in thanking Kate and Sharanja for bringing this important topic to us.